Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 84 of my 6G Music Podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. Hello, so first of all, I'd like to welcome all of you to part two of episode number 84 of my 6G Music Podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, or on Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is this? I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 24-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a huge 6G Music fan slash expert slash nerd. In each week of this podcast, I take one song by one artist in the 60s and put the show in two parts. First part of the show, I talk about my opinion on the song and why I think it's so good, or why I think it sucks, and do my own personality on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics. And then the second part of the show, dig deep into the history behind that track. And that part of the show, I talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song was recorded at, the musicians on the track, whether that be the session musicians or the band members on the track, and the history behind the song, what inspired the songwriter to write the song, and also where the studio of the song was recorded at, where that studio was located at, and the label of the song was originally released on, and where that label is located at, and the year, month it was released, and the peak position the song made up originally on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. All that is in the second part of the show. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's band, which was The Byrds. But first, before we get into that, we got to dive into something, a genre of music that we haven't quite covered yet on my podcast yet. And that genre of music is known as folk rock. Now, if you're wondering, what the heck is folk rock? Well, to better explain it to you, we have to get into the first part of the equation, which is essentially folk, and what that genre of music was all about. Okay, so the best explain to you what folk music was all about, for those of you out there who may not know what it is, because there's two parts to this. There's folk music and there's rock music, and then those parts kind of combine. But to basically explain to you what folk music was all about, it's basically one of the oldest forms of one of the oldest genres of music you can possibly think of, because there are some folk songs have lyrics that date back to a few centuries ago. But the best way to explain to you exactly what folk music is traditionally, popular song lyrics are written in a very straightforward way, meaning you were oftentimes directly communicating with one specific person, and there really wasn't that much of a mystery as to what the song is lyrically is about. And in the history of pop music, it's rare for pop songs to dive into subject matter that's technically considered taboo or over the edge as far as what is acceptable in society in whatever time period the song was written in. You know, because let's face it, I mean, most pop songs, especially back in the 50s and 60s, I mean, they were just sort of innocent, sort of fluffy songs that were all about love and romantic relationships. And most of them were very, very direct, and nobody really questioned exactly what these songs were about. But on the other hand, in folk music, many songs use beautiful poetic tools such as similes and metaphors and lyrical imagery, almost to the point that it was difficult to understand exactly what the lyric of the song was about. I mean, if you think about it, folk songs were very much like poems. You know, there are poems set to music, and it was different than what was going on with pop music, where in pop everything was so direct, and essentially folk was essentially, you know, these very beautiful poems set to music. And oftentimes, folk songs tackled controversial subject matters that many times got political, and they were definitely a far cry from the squeaky clean, innocent, fun lyrics that pop songs in the late 50s and early 60s evoked. You know, because oftentimes, you know, folk songs talked about things, there was a lot of imagination in folk songs. And usually when people listen to them, they always seem to question exactly what the song was about. Because a lot of folk songs contained very hidden sort of messages underneath the lyrics that were not necessarily, where you really had to listen like more than like, you had to listen to the song at least four or five times or even more than just to get exactly what the song is about. And some people never really understood what these songs were about lyrically. But essentially, folk songs, you know, they had this sort of thing where it wasn't as surfacey, or and it wasn't as sort of, very blatant or obvious as it was in other, you know, pop songs from that time period. And also, folk songs often told stories that were about things that happened 80 to 100 years ago. So, you know, the other thing about folk songs is that, yes, they were very political and very, you know, sort of under the, they contain a lot of under the surface messages, but also a lot of folk songs were passed down from generation to generation, like 100 to 200 years ago, you know, and because of this, you know, the reason why these songs are so ancient, you know, the writing credits as to who wrote these songs still remain a mystery today, because, you know, these songs are passed down from one person to the next person to the next person. And so because of this, nobody really knew exactly who wrote a lot of these songs. You know, they've just been recorded over and over and over again to the point where nobody, you know, I mean, essentially these things happen like several years ago. And, you know, that's why most folk songs, like, there is no writing credit. It's just, you know, whoever came up with the arrangement of the song essentially gets all the money. But anyways, the key thing to remember about folk music is that it was written and originally recorded on acoustic instruments, meaning with just acoustic guitar and nothing else, really. And maybe like a harmonica and upright bass in addition to the acoustic guitar. And when folk music was extremely popular, nobody really had the bright idea of covering these songs electrically with a full band setup until this band came along. You see, the Byrds are essentially one of the first ever bands to have huge success covering folk songs and doing them by plugging in electric instruments and playing them with electric guitar, bass, and drums. As all the members of the Byrds were essentially folk musicians who exclusively played acoustically in all the groups they were in before the band even existed, because trust me, in the early 60s, you know, playing with electric instruments like electric guitar, bass, and drums, you know, wasn't even on their mind at the time in the early 60s. But that all changed when the Beatles came to America in 1964 and literally rocked the entire country with their own totally self-contained electric full band setup. And the Byrds essentially decided to take their initial setup of electric guitar, bass, and drums that the Beatles adapted and, you know, combine that with them covering folk songs to go along with their overall sound. And voila, you had the sound of the Byrds. But the band also had an in with, and at the time, a songwriter who was essentially a folk singer who, instead of adapting traditional folk lyrics, wrote all of his own songs and was already huge amongst the college folk music scene. But he had yet to break out in the teenage pop market. That is, until the band covered one of his songs and did it completely different than the way any other group had did one of his tunes previously, and thus breaking him to the mainstream pop world. But the band also helped pioneer other genres of music, such as psychedelic rock and country rock, when at the time, those genres are unheard of and totally brand new. And that songwriter, who I was talking about, by the way, was Bob Dylan. Thing is, we'll get into that a little bit more in a few minutes, but first, let's talk about the history behind this band, because even though their first hit came out in the spring of 1965, and wound up being number one, and that's pretty insane for a band's first single to go all the way number one, the story of this band started way before they even got a hold of their very first number one single. The original nucleus of the band consisted of Roger McGuinn, who at the time was known as Jim McGuinn, and Gene Clark and David Crosby. Essentially, they all met each other at the Troubadour, with each one was in a different folk group before they all came together and formed the trio. Jim McGuinn was in the Limelighters and the Chad Mitchell Trio, and he also played with Judy Collins and Bobby Darin. At the time, he was living in New York before he moved out to California, you know, playing for Judy Collins and Bobby Darin, and was also a songwriter in the Brill Building. And David Crosby was in the Les Bastards Balladeers, and Gene Clark was in the New Christian Minstrels. You know, they were all essentially playing acoustically and playing with just, you know, acoustic guitars and basses, and that's it in the beginning. But essentially what happened was that Roger McGuinn decided to move to California from New York and got a gig at the Troubadour opening up for Hoyt Axton, who at the time was a folk singer. And Gene Clark was there, and he approached Roger McGuinn and asked him if he'd be interested in doing a duet of Beatles covers and Beatles-esque versions of traditional folk songs. And at the time, you know, Roger McGuinn was already doing this in New York, essentially playing in all the folk clubs in Greenwich Village doing Beatles songs. At the time, he got a lot of flack for it, you know, because the folk purists at the time did not like, you know, a guy playing acoustic versions of Beatles songs. They thought it was just unheard of and weird, you know. And essentially, when Gene Clark and Roger McGuinn got together, they were essentially just a duo doing Beatles-esque versions of folk songs and Beatles covers just done acoustically, sort of like Peter and Gordon. And McGuinn accepted that role, and it wasn't long before David Crosby also joined them after he introduced himself to the duo also at the Troubadour. And all of a sudden, they became a trio after they realized how much of a good blend their voices had together, and they eventually called themselves the Jet Set. And the reason why they called themselves the Jet Set was because Roger McGuinn at the time was a huge fan of aerodynamics and planes and doing and all that stuff. So that's why in the beginning they called themselves the Jet Set. David Crosby knew a manager named Jim Dixon who had access to a recording studio called World Pacific Studios in L.A., and he sooner or later became the business manager for the Byrds. And it was there that the band essentially got tighter and started to rehearse a lot more as a unit. And basically, if you don't know what World Pacific Studios was, it was a jazz studio in L.A. that all the famous jazz cats recorded at. But after they were done recording there at nighttime, that's when the Byrds came in and started rehearsing together and they started developing their sound and starting getting tighter as a unit. And their sound was essentially a blend of Beatles-style pop and Bob Dylan-esque folk. And they originally started out as a trio with McGuinn, Clark, and Crosby, but then sooner than later, Michael Clark was then added to the group as a drummer in mid-1964, and he basically became a drummer, even though, and this is totally true, he did not have a whole lot of experience as a professional drummer in Los Angeles, because at the time he's only had done a few gigs as a conga player. And so because of this, the band's first couple of singles, which they recorded before they got signed to Columbia Records, were released with a session bass player Ray Pullman and drummer Earl Palmer, because at the time the band didn't have a permanent drummer or a bass player. And so essentially, before they got signed to Columbia, the first couple of singles they released were on Elektra Records, because their manager Jim Dixon basically arranged a one or two off single deal with Elektra Records. But when those songs didn't chart, they were quickly dropped by Elektra. But shortly after that, the band started to use a lot of the same gear the Beatles used on A Hard Day's Night, you know, because that movie came out and they decided to acquire a lot of the same type of gear that the Beatles were using in that movie, such as the Rickenbacker and Gretsch guitars and the Ludwig drum kit. And the band also added a bass player to the group, Chris Hillman, even though at the time, you know, how Michael Clark wasn't an experienced drummer, you know, Chris Hillman neither was an experienced bass player. And he had more experience in country and folk versus pop and rock and roll. And he was primarily a mandolin player and not a bass player. And just before they got signed to Columbia Records, Jim Dixon got a hold at the time, and unrecorded at least professionally, a Bob Dylan song called Mr. Tambourine Man that the band didn't like at first. I mean, when they first heard it, they thought, you know, they thought it was okay. They thought it was kind of mediocre. But then he asked the group to dig a little deeper into it because they wanted material with substance and depth and not fluff, as they called it back in the day. I mean, they didn't want to sing another ooh-wee baby I love you song. So they listened to it again. And Roger McGuinn, who at the time was known as Jim McGuinn, keep that in mind, had the idea of converting the song from being basically, it was originally in 2/4 time. And if you don't know what that means, you know, basically, you know, there's two beats in a measure versus four. But anyways, the song was originally in 2/4 time, and Roger McGuinn decided to play it in 4/4 time. And, you know, Bob at the time knew that the band was rehearsing their song. They hadn't recorded it yet, but they knew that they were playing it. And when Bob went in the studio, World Pacific Studios, and heard them heard the band do the song with this way in 4/4 time, he flipped out and he said, "Oh my God, you can dance to it. This is great. This is awesome." And he granted the band its full seal of approval for their version of the song. He was like, "Okay, you guys can record this song. I really like your version of it." And then they got signed to Columbia Records after they got a recommendation from a jazz trumpet player who was on Columbia Records by the name of Miles Davis. Because basically what happened was that, their manager, Jim Dixon, basically called up Columbia Records and says, "Hey, do you guys want to sign this band?" And then he called up Miles Davis and said, "Hey, I got this band called The Bird. Can you pass them on to the heads of Columbia and see if they want to sign them?" And basically, Miles Davis was like, "Does this band swing?" And I'm like, "Yes, they do." "Okay, cool. I'll forward them over to the heads of Columbia, and then I'll tell them about him." And then basically, they got signed after that happened. Okay, so once they got signed to Columbia Records, they were paired with a very young and hip Columbia A&R man / producer named Terry Melcher, who a few years earlier was previously in a group called the Ripcords, who did a surf car pop songs like "Hey Little Cobra" and "Free Window Coupe." Terry was the one who decided their first single should have session musicians playing on it instead of members of the band, with the exception of Roger McGuinn playing 12-string guitar. And they did that so that way their chances of having a hit song could be increased. Also because the band's inexperience of being musicians themselves on a professional recording level. And it's also the other thing that they did when they recorded Mr. Tambourine Man is that they only kept one verse out of the original version of the song, because Bob Dylan's version had several verses and it was like 4 or 5 minutes long. Well, you know, at the time with AM radio, I've talked about this before, songs had to be under 3 minutes if they wanted to get played on AM radio. So essentially what they did is that they kept out one verse from the original Bob Dylan version, and that's what they played. They repeated the chorus twice. And essentially, the members of the Wrecking Crew that played on the record include Hal Blaine on drums, Larry Nechtel on bass, Leon Russell on piano, and Jerry Cole on rhythm guitar. And interestingly enough, their electric version of Mr. Tambourine Man predated the release of Bob Dylan's breakout electric full band single, Like a Rolling Stone. His first full, their version of Mr. Tambourine Man, which is played with a band, came out before Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, and it predated Like a Rolling Stone by 4 or 5 months. As a hit number one before that song was recorded professionally. So if you think about it, the Birds were single-handedly responsible for bringing awareness to Dylan into the mainstream pop market, because Dylan hadn't even had his own huge hit as a pop artist when Mr. Tambourine Man was number one on the pop charts and Billboard. And in turn, doing one of his songs plugged in with a full band inspired him to do the same thing for the lead single on his landmark album Highway 61 Revisited, which was Like a Rolling Stone. So really, if it hadn't been for the Birds, there's still a good possibility Billy Dylan would still be playing acoustically without a band. So yeah, Mr. Tambourine Man, the Birds version, which was recorded with the record, was recorded in January 1965 and released March of that year, and then it hit number one May, June of 1965. So it was, it was again a number one hit before Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone was recorded with the full band. But now let's get into the history behind this week's song, which was the follow-up to Mr. Tambourine Man. Okay, so I'm sure a lot of you on here are probably wondering why the heck the song wasn't a top 40 hit when it first came out. But first, let me explain something to you about this band in the early days as a group. You see, at the time, most of the band didn't have any amazing songwriter chops, hence why they built a reputation for themselves by covering folk songs that they didn't write and doing them electrically. But there was one guy in the group who was more than capable of being a songwriter in his own right, despite the fact the songs that he wrote never achieved the chart success they probably should have, and that was Gene Clark. And Gene wrote this song a year before they got signed to Columbia Records, when the band was doing their nightly residency at Heroes Club. He wrote it about a girl that he was seeing at the time, and he thought she was kind of funny and kind of strange, and she started to bother Gene a lot. And that's when he got the idea for the song, which was "I'll Probably Feel a Whole Lot Better When You're Gone." And Gene also later on admitted that the song's main riff was directly lifted from a huge hit in 1964 from a British invasion band called The Searchers, called Needles and Pins. Now, I want you to keep in mind that the band's first number one single is the only song they recorded that they didn't play on. You know, Mr. Tambourine Man. Everything after that featured members of the band playing themselves on they basically, every single after Mr. Tambourine Man had the members of the band playing the instruments on the records without any studio musicians. Now, finally, let's get into exactly why this song wasn't a hit. Okay, so after Mr. Tambourine Man became a huge number one hit, the Byrds were eager to present themselves as songwriters and come out of the shell as an original band and not just a folk rock cover band. But when the Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man went to number one, Columbia Records was eager to release a follow-up single to their huge number one hit. And their thinking was that if the Byrds had a huge number one hit with the electric cover version of a Bob Dylan song, they could do that again with another Dylan cover in their own unique folk rock style, despite the fact that they were very hesitant to do this because they thought that if they released another Bob Dylan song as a rock song, that they would be typecast as a Bob Dylan rock cover band. And when they found out that Cher was going to release a cover version of this exact same song out in the same week, they thought that their version was going to be a bigger hit because of their already established street cred with their version of Mr. Tambourine Man becoming a number one record. And surely enough, when both versions got released virtually in the same week, Cher's version went top 10, while the Byrds' version stalled at number 40. And while their first ever original song that ever got released, written by one of the members of the band, Gene Clark, which was I'll Feel a Whole Lot Better, that song was released as the B-side of their version of Bob Dylan's All I Really Want to Do. Firstly, dooming it to not be a hit at all. And if you ask me, I think that the band shouldn't have released their cover version of All I Really Want to Do, knowing that they would be competing against Cher's version of this song. And they should have released I'll Feel a Whole Lot Better as the A-side, with another song as the B-side. If they did that, there's a chance that I'll Feel a Whole Lot Better would have been a huge runaway top 10 hit everywhere, not just in LA. And that's it. It obviously was a strong enough song that it could have been released as an A-side. But this was one of those many examples where the label got things wrong as to their initial assumption as to which song would be the most popular commercially successful song after it got released. They were thinking that, you know, All I Really Want to Do would become a huge hit, and their version would trample over Cher's version, which would be out in the same week. But they were wrong, because Cher's version became a top 10 runaway hit record, and all the Byrds version, you know, stalled at number 40 and wasn't really that much of a hit at all. And, you know, splitting the airplay between both versions, while some DJs and some radio stations played the Byrds version All I Really Want to Do, Cher's version got the lion's share of the radio airplay, which is kind of surprising because, you know, and which makes sense because at the time Sonny and Cher were huge. They just had a huge hit with I Got You Babe, and they had at least, by September 65, they had at least three or four songs in the top 40. And, you know, All I Really Want to Do was Cher's breakout solo single, and, you know, they were hugely popular, so that makes sense as to why her version was the bigger hit. But like I said before, I really do think that they made a mistake by, you know, releasing their cover version of All I Really Want to Do, knowing that they would be competing against another version out of the same week. Before we end this podcast, let's do a little epilogue and find out what happened with this band after the song's release. The band managed to have one more huge number one hit following the same formula they used on Dylan, this time with a different songwriter. And the folk singer being Pete Seeger, and the song, and he also wrote the song too. And the name of the tune was Turn, Turn, Turn. And they discovered the song because Roger McGuinn, I was originally playing the song in folk groups with Judy Collins in New York before he was in the Byrds. And also, Gene Clark soon left the band after his bandmates got jealous of him earning the most money in the band for him being the principal songwriter in the group. And plus, he had an extreme fear of flying, and this is a very important point I want to make to you, because at the time, the band was getting offered to tour across the world and across the country, And Gene Clark didn't want to fly anywhere because he had a fear of flying. And at the time, you know, in order for them to get to these places, they had to get on the plane. And Roger McGuinn basically said, look it, man, if you can't fly with us and you can't be a member of the Birds, and that's essentially when he left. And the band soon ventured into psychedelic rock after they wrote a song about their first European tour in the UK that many people misinterpreted as being about drugs. But the song's far out and unconventional guitar solo that was borderline jazz, with influences from jazz sax player John Coltrane and the Indian sitar player Ravi Shankar. And that element in the song made people think about drugs in a rock song in a way people never would have imagined before in a rock song. And even, let's face it, I mean, the song wasn't really about drugs. It was essentially about their first European tour in the UK. And essentially that's what they wrote the song about. It wasn't about drugs at all. And the band also switched producers after they had a falling out with Terry Melcher. And essentially what happened was that Jim Dixon, who was at the time their business manager, really wanted to produce the group himself, you know, and they essentially wanted Terry Melcher to leave the group as the group's producer, even though he had produced two number one hits for the band and two very successful albums for them. And essentially when they requested Terry Melcher to leave the group as the group's producer, you know, Jim Dixon never got the opportunity to produce the band himself, as Columbia assigned them another A&R guy, you know, as the group's producer, Alan Stanton. And then that's essentially what happened. He never got to produce the Birds. But then shortly after that, Terry Melcher then focused all of his attention and energy on producing for Paul Revere and the Raiders, who were on the same label as the Birds at the time. And the band also got fed up with David Crosby once they kind of got around to their fifth album, which was the Fabulous Bird Brothers, because he wanted full creative control over the band, and he was also making unnecessary political comments during the band's Monterey Pop Festival appearance. And trust me, the members of the group did not like that at all. And he sooner than later left the band and stumbled upon Stephen Stills and Graham Nash a year later, who were no longer in bands at that time. And, Graham Nash was no longer in Hollies and Stephen Stills was no longer with Buffalo Springfield. And a year later, they formed Crosby, Stills, and Nash. When the band was down to McGuinn and Hillman, because Gene Clark had left, David Crosby had left, and Michael Clark had also left, they added on Graham Parsons and started diving into country music mixed with rock, making them one of the first ever bands to do that. But the main and final point I want to say about this band before I go in too depth with their history is that the band broke ground by literally inventing subgenres of 60s rock nobody ever really would have thought of at the time, and were met with tons of critical acclaim, despite the fact that their critical success didn't necessarily match with their commercial success. I mean, let's face it, they didn't have as many big hits as some of the other 60s bands from that era. I mean, you know, while Gary Lewis and the Playboys and the Rascals and Love and Spoonful were having huge hits on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, you know, they had a couple number one hits, but then they had some other songs that were really, really good that struggled to get even into the top 40 at times. I mean, they had a couple smaller top 40 hits, but essentially they weren't nearly as having many hits as some of the other bands at the time. And while in the beginning they were essentially a nucleus of both Bob Dylan and the Beatles, because Roger McGuinn's lead vocals very much sound like a cross between, John Lennon and Bob Dylan, they in return influenced both of those bands. Because when the press asked the Beatles what was their favorite American band, their immediate response was the Birds. And they became great friends with the Birds after they did some tours together. And here's a little specific, something you probably didn't even know about. If I Needed Someone, which was a track off of Rubber Soul, written by George Harrison, was directly influenced, you know, by the Birds. As George essentially based the riff off of a song in the Birds version of The Bells of Rimini, which was a track off of one of their albums, one of their earlier albums. And Bob Dylan essentially plugged in and went electric after the Birds covered one of his songs electrically. So essentially the Beatles were influenced by the Birds and the Birds were influenced by the Beatles. And then there was a big cross-pollination between both those groups, and the same with Bob Dylan. So that concludes part two of episode number 84 of my Sookie Music Podcast, The Millennial Lowerback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and if you found some interesting, cool, and really out there facts about this band, The Birds, and you never really knew anything about them before, but I will make a full disclaimer for this specific band. If you guys have already seen that movie Echo and the Canyon that came out last year, which is about the Laurel Canyon music scene in LA in the 60s, and I apologize if I'm reiterating you the same information that you already knew, because a lot of what I talked about on this episode of this podcast is talked about in that movie. And if you've already seen it, I'm sorry if I'm, you know, reiterating you the same information that you already, you know, knew about this band, The Birds. But if you didn't see that movie and did learn some really cool and interesting facts about this band, The Birds, from listening to this episode of this podcast, then you can email me at samltwilliatiCloud.com. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies and check out more of my original music at samlilliesmusic.net. And also, a couple of things you can check out there in the description of this episode of this podcast are a link to this week's song and the links to the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. There you'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including some songs that I have talked about in some of the interview episodes I've done. Now, this should give you an idea for what kind of songs I talk about on my show. And if you go check them out, if there's some songs on there that I haven't talked about on my show yet that I should cover next, and you want to send those ideas to me, then you should do that. You can email me at samltwilliatiCloud.com, and you can also reach out to me on Instagram, iHeartOldies. And another thing you can check out is the official Redbubble merch store for this podcast. That's also in the description of this episode of this podcast. The link to that is in there. And what's really cool about it is that I have all these really cool merchandise items, and they're all priced differently. And I've got this super cool logo that I had someone else design, but I came up with myself. It is basically the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode and keep on trucking, tie-dye font, and with my name, my podcast on the bottom. I really appreciate it if you can go on there and check out some of the merch items on there. And if that gives you any, if you decide to purchase anything, that's totally cool. I really love that. But if not, that's okay. I love it if you could at least give me some feedback on the price of each item in the store. And of course, exactly what you think of the song, of the logo as well. So, you know, I really appreciate it if you can do that. And also, there's one more thing I want to mention to you guys before in this episode of this podcast is that for those of you who've been wondering exactly when I'm going to release some of my own original music, it's going to happen this year. I'm going to finally release some new original music this year. I'm not really sure exactly when, probably sometime, late spring, early summer. So I'll let you guys know when that is about to happen. I'll definitely give you guys a pretty good heads up when I have a official release date and the songs are selected and everything. But right now, I'm just starting the process of, you know, finishing up the recordings for the songs and getting everything ready for it, you know, and just doing, dotting my dots and T's and everything. But I'll let you guys know when I officially release this new EP of mine. This will be my first official release in 3 years, so it's going to be really, really cool. And, I'm hoping that some of you out there who listen to this podcast are more curious to hear some of my own music. You know, since I am a songwriter and a musician myself, I'm not just a music historian like I talk about on this podcast all the time. I do write my own music. So I'm hoping that for those of you who do like my podcast and like what you hear and you find it really cool, that you'll be curious to hear some of my own music and to see what that's like as well. I mean, I have stuff up online right now, but that's stuff that I recorded a long time ago. So this will be some new music that you've never heard before. You know, at least if you're someone who's listening to this podcast randomly, you're not like a really good friend of mine. But anyway, so yeah, so I'll give you guys a pretty good heads up as to when that's going to happen. I'll let you guys know when I have the release date and when what songs are going to be on there. And I might put out like a single every month following to the release. We'll see. But I just want to let you guys know that. And so I'm Sam Williams. And thank you guys again for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please keep things moving.